Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
BT Sport Pods.
Hi, welcome to Michael Calvin's Football People. I'm joined by Miguel Delaney of The Independent and by Dominic Fifield of The Athletic. My special guest is James Milner. He captained Liverpool and Madrid, but couldn't prevent their elimination from the Champions League. I came away from our chat convinced he has a long-term future at Anfield in the coaching department. In the short term, Manchester City will be the favourites when the draw for the last eight of the Champions League is made on Friday. So Dom, is Europe about to bow to the inevitable?
I'm pretty sure this time last year we said exactly the same thing, and possibly the year before that and the year before that. Everything screams out that Manchester City and the Champions League it's there for the taking. It's theirs if they find the form at the right times, if they find the performances at the right times. But, you know, until that draw is made on Friday and we know who they're up against and then who they get in the semi-finals and the final, it's almost pointless now. We've been here so many times before. Well, the one thing that is certain is that when you wallop a team in the fashion that they did in that second leg, then the shockwaves are going to be felt around the competition and everybody else is going to look at them and think, yeah, well, if we do come up against them, we've got to come up with a contingency plan to try and nullify Haaland, to try and stop the supply line into him from De Bruyne, from Grealish, from Foden, from Mahrez. And, you know, even when you just list those talents and others in that team, then the sort of size of the task of confronting them and beating them and knocking them out is laid bare.
Yeah, you were in Madrid while that game was going on, Migs, in preparation for the Liverpool game. What impact did that City victory have over there?
Not that much. I mean, I suppose, which is maybe a reflection of Madrid's confidence. And I must say, one of the things that struck about the Madrid-Liverpool game was how it feels Madrid have gone up a level from last season, where last season, like, you know, the most successful club in European history were held up as sort of upstarts, kind of defying aging or transition. Whereas now, and I suppose this sometimes happens when teams win that major trophy in that way, they feel a much more fully formed side, much more conviction, with so many of the younger players like Camavinga going on to a higher level. So from that perspective, I have to say it didn't make much impact. Madrid or Madrid in that sense. As Ancelotti said after the game, everyone knows us. But I also wonder as well, and that, as Dom said, it's the scale of the thrashing that potentially kind of sends a warning to the rest of Europe. But this isn't really new. I mean, in Guardiola's seven seasons at City, this is the third time he's played Bundesliga opposition in the last 16, and he's put 22 goals past them, which is probably kind of an indication of kind of wider issues in European football. But it's been one of those things that happens in a bit of an increasing sense of repetitiveness in the Champions League, I have to say, this season at least. But certainly, the one thing, it does feel like in this last eight, there's three clear kind of elite or favourites to our City, Bayern Munich and Madrid, with Napoli then kind of seen as maybe the great, not quite dark horses, but the potential revelations.
Yeah, well, with Erling Haaland, you know, what more can we say? I suppose we've got to say something. Why don't we have a quick sweepstake on how many goals he's going to end up with at the end of the season? If they win everything, they've got potentially 18 games left.
How many has he got at the moment? 39?
39. I'm going to take 55.
Oh, that was what I was going to say.
That was literally my figure as well.
Can we go with that?
We'll go with 55. Yeah. You know, it's also obvious, I think, that City being City will add from a position of strength in the summer. Who's going to be their next marquee signing, do you think, Dom? You know, I made a point of watching Napoli on Wednesday night just to get a sense of whether they could become, you know, viable Champions League title winners. And I was convinced, I must admit. What about Kvicha Kvaratskhelia? He's already been compared to George Best. He looks like a City stroke United type player.
Yeah, look, he's a fantastic talent. I don't know how you'd crowbar him in necessarily. I mean, there are plenty of other talents in the way in that area. When you look at City, I mean, there are not many areas of obvious weakness. I don't know. My instinct always sort of gravitates towards a midfielder. But then I guess if Cancelo's out on loan and it may have burnt his bridges with City, possibly strengthening in that area might be a way to go. But yeah, you're right. They will certainly use the transfer windows available to them before any sanctions might be imposed, however long the legal proceedings are going to rumble along in the background, to ensure that they are in a position of strength and they are ever evolving, ever improving. Because even if they won the Champions League this season and ended that sort of quest that Pep Guardiola has been on since his appointment there, I don't think that their ambition, their thirst for more success, is going to be quenched. They're going to move on. They're going to snowball onto something else, and they'll want to see off the next challenge to them domestically, which presumably will be Arsenal for a while, and a revamped Liverpool, and a, you know, see where Chelsea go next. And they will be up for taking on those challenges. Manchester United down the road, you know, under Ten Hag, are potentially a different proposition, and so they will strengthen them, and they will always be scope for improvement in Pep's mind.
Yeah, Napoli, Migs, 18 points clear in Serie A. You know, what really impressed me, you know, there is a great package there, isn't there? You know, the recruitment is terrific. Tactical organisation is fantastic. There's fluidity, speed on transition, and those natural goal scorers they've got. And there has to be a but here, doesn't there? Is this their best and only chance to win the Champions League simply because of the economic realities and the inferiority of certain clubs compared to the English?
The one thing I would broadly agree, and from a wider perspective, isn't it kind of a classic example of the whole boiling frog when this season, when Napoli, who are one of Serie A's strongest, one of the great names of Italian football history, and Serie A itself, who out of nowhere almost have become the best represented team in the Champions League quarterfinals, when they're kind of held up as revelations. I mean, Italy, it's pretty remarkable. But, and I would generally agree with you, the one thing I do think, first of all, I suppose Napoli, out of all those sort of clubs, are notoriously difficult to do business with. And one of the reasons they're actually here is because they managed to keep on the talent for so long, like Koulibaly. Oh, it was only in the summer that they finally decided, well, okay, let's let these players go. Now, that was seen as a bit of a potential kind of, that the club were going to go into a transition at that point because of that. Instead, it was the making of this new, young, brilliant team. And I do wonder as well, say if they don't win the Champions League this season, but they win Serie A, as looks inevitable now, whether there's at least the emotional persuasion to make Osimhen and Kvaratskhelia stay for one more season for that big punt of the Champions League. That's the only kind of potential edge to that. But yeah, just with the normal market forces, the way the game is going, the way everything is subsumed in the Premier League now, you would think certainly Osimhen at least might move on in the summer. And once one big player goes like that, it's usually kind of the start of the end.
Yeah, well, they'll be queuing around the block for Osimhen, won't they, Dom? Will Chelsea be at the head of that queue, do you think? You know, there is a link, if you think about it, emotionally at least, that his hero is Didier Drogba. You know, the thought of emulating him would probably be some form of motivation. Any chance?
Well, you've always got to say there's a chance because Chelsea aren't afraid to to spend big money, but I think the priority at Chelsea initially will be clearing some players off the books. And they also have this rather big issue of what happens to Romelu Lukaku at the end of the season. I know there was some talk in Milan this week that Inter expect him to go back to Chelsea at the end of his, what has been a rather disappointing loan move to date, although that may end up just being the sort of first negotiating point over some kind of arrangement to keep him there in future. But I think as much as Chelsea's transfer policy has felt a bit scattergun and just buy, whatever's out there, whatever talent you can identify, at some point they're going to have to get together Clearlake and Tom Boehly and Potter and the numerous recruitment staff that they've taken on board and work out a coherent plan as to what happens next. And I suspect that will begin by clearing some bodies off the books.
Yeah. How revealing do you think it is, Migs, that, you know, we are, the main area of conjecture is precisely that, you know, who are they going to, you know, get rid of in the market, you know, rather than looking at their realistic chances in the Champions League. I can't see him going beyond the quarterfinals, can you?
I'm not sure, I must say. I mean, so much is going to depend on the draw.
Yeah.
I mean, and I already know you would think that that four I picked out earlier would probably be kind of the prospective best case semi-final in terms of kind of, I suppose, the competitive diversity of it. Now, I suppose like Milan, Inter, Benfica, my Chelsea might resist that. This is one case just because it does feel like a bit of a split competition. More, and it's usually at this point of the season, but this is relevant to what we're saying about Man City as well, where the competition is getting more exacting. Instead, because of where a number of clubs are, including Chelsea, it does feel like actually it's kind of clearing, and it depends, and it's more important than ever who gets who in this quarterfinal. And that could well lead to, I suppose, not quite a surprise winner, but something that doesn't. I mean, again, the classic example is 2021, when it all looked like it was going to be set up for Man City, and Chelsea and Tuchel undercut them. And that's also the nature of knockout football as well. It also would be actually just in it from a wider perspective, given that we've started this talking about City actually doing it. If they did do it at a point where, in echoes of 2020, although they were eventually in the Cass case, the punishment of a Champions League ban was overturned. If they won it while they have these charges for multiple alleged breaches of the Premier League's financial fair play rules. But yeah, again, I think everything is going to come down to the draw on Friday, which is much more important than ever.
The Bundesliga's inferiority, economically at least, has been felt. Only Bayern remain, you know, perennial contenders, aren't they, Dom?
Absolutely. I mean, I watched the PSG game, and you just look at the talent that was on their bench. It was absolutely terrifying. I mean, they're very few clubs, Premier League or others, who can boast having that much quality on the bench to fling into a game against, you know, Paris Saint-Germain. I haven't had the greatest of times in Europe this season, I suppose you could argue, but they were considered contenders by some for that competition. And yet here we are with Bayern Munich starting the game, going into the lead, and then bringing on Gnabry, bringing on Leroy Sané, bringing on Sadio Mane, bringing on Joao Cancelo. I mean, it's that's ludicrous. That is absolutely ludicrous. So, yeah, they would be a team to avoid. And, you know, if you are Manchester City, you'd rather hope that, I don't know, Bayern Munich drew Real Madrid and one of those two got knocked out, and then you could just sneak in on the outside, because I wouldn't fancy taking on them with the quality. And of those starters, I mean, just a word on Musiala, who I know he had his moments and was brilliant at times in the World Cup, but his performances against top quality experienced opponents at that age, quite remarkable. He is some talent.
It certainly is, yeah. Liverpool, I think we, you know, agree, don't we, that there's going to be a summer of change ahead for them, Migs. What was the fallout like from that defeat in the Bernabeu? And also, just looking forward, do you think they could even dare to contemplate selling Mo Salah?
Well, see, evidently, I mean, as you've implied there, Mike, they need significant overhaul. I mean, even now they're using 7 to 9 players from that team that was so successful for 4 to 5 years. So they really do need big change. But of course, what completed the last big change? Well, while they were obviously putting everything in place, and you can see that with signings like Gakpo and the introduction of players like Bajic, what really completed it, of course, was the sale of one big player in Coutinho that allowed them to truly complete the side with enough funding for Alisson and for Van Dijk. And you do wonder now, especially given there is such a need for change, whether, yeah, it is a time to sell one of the big names for the point of regeneration. This is the level they're at now, and that's what they have to start thinking about. Because otherwise, that's how you let kind of a stagnation to kind of affect the club. And there was a bit of a feel. I mean, it's interesting. It's got a bit back and forth, especially with the 7-0 win over Manchester United, that did see Gakpo, Darwin and Salah complement each other really well. But the feel is still a kind of the end of a cycle. Now, I know we've been saying that for some time, and even Liverpool withstood it last season, but that was genuinely the atmosphere around the game last night. And even the fact that we didn't see that kind of great stirring response for Liverpool, it was like we were always waiting for them. Now, of course, a lot of that had to do with Real Madrid and how superbly they control things. But it's interesting from that perspective as well, actually, because if you want an example, I know a lot of people are loath to criticise how Real Madrid go about their business, especially given wider ambitions to the Super League and that. But they've actually been a model of keeping kind of quality players there while gradually bringing through. It's amazing how, and it was basically in a response to kind of state-owned clubs and the power of the Premier League, that Madrid kind of changed their model, which was always going for the next big thing. And suddenly now you've got Camavinga, who I thought was brilliant last night. Vinicius, of course, has grown into one of the best players in the world. Players that they've brought in over the last few years that Liverpool had done well. And of course, all this articulated by this battle over Jude Bellingham.
Yeah. Well, James Milner is, by common consent, a manager in the making. It wouldn't surprise me if he takes up some form of player-coach role next season. He certainly talked with quiet authority about culture, coaching, and his future when we met before the Madrid tie. James, welcome, and obviously thanks for your time. I once spent a season in the dressing room at Millwall for a book, and the culture was created and maintained by 4 or 5 senior pros who set and sustained the standards, both professionally and personally, with the group. Now, obviously, I'm not aware of the dynamics of your dressing room, but I suspect it's quite similar. I called those 4 or 5 senior pros the governors. Are you one of Liverpool's governors?
Probably, yeah. I think, when the manager came in, he wanted to set about early, and he got the team to vote who they wanted to have in their captain's committee, 4 or 5 players. So obviously it was the captain, Jordan, was one, and I was the other, and then voted for the other 3. And that's changed over time, obviously, with players leaving and things like that. But the players always had their say, and that's always worked well. So those are the guys who, if ever there's a meeting needed or take messages up, and if the manager wants to spread a feeling throughout the camp or something without holding a meeting himself, you know, he'll say what he's looking for to us guys. But that's always been the way it's been done. And, you know, I think it's obviously very important, but we have a very good group here and everyone gets on very well. You naturally have the people from certain areas of the world who sit on a table together and things like that. But if you chuck any 2 players from anywhere in the world in this team together, you know, they'd have a great chat and everyone gets really well, and that's really important. But I think we've always tried to instill a lot in the younger players as well, try and make them feel at home as soon as possible, but let them know that they have responsibilities as well, and they're encouraged to, you know, speak, talk on the field, and make sure that they feel like they have a voice also, which is important.
Yeah, because is the intensity of this team at its best a reflection of that sort of collective character, if you like? Because I saw a session recently with Gilbert Anoka, who's done a lot of work with the All Blacks, you know, and he was the one who came up with the no dickheads rule, which is pretty much common sense more than anything else. So is the intensity of your team a product of the attitude that you just talked about?
I think so. I think it obviously starts with the manager and what he needs and what he wants. And then obviously that has to be taken down through the dressing room as well. But I think how we play and how we've always defended since the manager's come in, it's probably a bit different to other teams. And we defend in a way which is pretty aggressive, pretty front-footed. And if one person's not quite on the game or not quite switched on, or they're a few yards late or they're a bit out of position, the whole team gets found out, and that's how we defend. It's not one that you can wait and sort of recover. So it's one of those, if we go, we all go together, and that needs intensity. That needs everybody switched on. And, you know, I think that responsibility, knowing that every single player matters, every yard matters within that unit when you're defending. And that's also, you know, you might have a starting 11 that starts 70% of the games, but then you might have players missing in other games. Like, you go back to the Barcelona game, and you know what an unbelievable result that was, but the players we had missing that night often gets forgot as well, and that's down to great coaching and a great team spirit, and the players who maybe haven't played as much that season as they would like, being ready to step in, know the job exactly, and be ready to play at the intensity needed in a game like that. I think that was what made the night even more special, if possible, because it was a real squad and group performance.
Mm. Is there a sense also of like personal accessibility, you know, maybe for some of the younger players who haven't got your experience? And on that point, you're 37, which is probably the new 31 because of all sorts of science and everything else, isn't it? What advice would you give as a 37-year-old to the 16-year-old who broke through at Leeds under Terry Venables?
It's a tough one, that. I don't know. I think it's the process, isn't it? It's hard to say. There's nothing major that I would say do this or that, which shows that I've always learnt on my way and looked at the senior players I was playing with. I've been fortunate for the players I've played with, the managers I've played with, and picked up things as I've gone. Obviously, if I had the football knowledge that I have now then, I'd have been a better player back then. But, you know, it doesn't work like that. But there's nothing major that I'd turn around and say, concentrate more on this or don't do that, which I suppose is a very good thing. And, you know, I've been fortunate to take a good path. But I think, like you say, it is important now that I can speed up any development of the younger guys where possible, in terms of, you know, I remember doing this wrong or that little mistake here and there. Nothing major, but little things that I've learned in the time. You know, recognising facts and players, young players, when they're not playing, signed to a big club. It's obviously a new thing, maybe not play as much as they want. You can recognise how they're feeling because you've been there as well. I've been there myself. I know exactly how you're feeling, and they obviously don't recognise that because they were really young when, if not, they might not have been born when I was in their position. They just see me as a senior player now. But
that's something to get your head around.
Yeah,
it?
Exactly. Yeah, and it was when you hear some of the birth dates when they're doing medical things or whatever, and you hear it was like the year you made your debut and they were born and things. So it's, but yeah, I think they don't recognise that. Then when you say, you know, I've been in this position before, and then they know you understand how they're feeling, and hopefully you can help them and just help them through that tough period, really.
Mm. Players used to love playing for Venners, didn't they? Why is that? And also, what are the common characteristics of the best managers and coaches that you've played for?
Yeah, I think in a way similar to Jurgen, probably, in terms of, you know, likeable character, you know, bubbly, what you see is what you got sort of character. And, you know, I think I'd have liked to experience Terry Venables as a more senior player, because obviously when you're a younger player, everything's like, you know, it's like a kid walking into a sweet shop. You know, you're not maybe understanding how everything works. You're keeping your head down, trying to, you know, spoke when spoken to, don't attract the attention of the senior boys with any lairish gear or saying anything. Keep your head down, do your job, clean your boots. You know, when you're on that training field, give as hard as you get and try and make an impact on the pitch. So it would have been nice to experience, you know, Terry as a senior player as well. But it was always great with me. He was, you know, I broke through it very young at 16. And at that stage, you're normally doing your technique work with the academy and stuff like that. And obviously, once you get to first team level, it's just team preparation, preparing for the next game. So he was always important. It was like in the afternoon to make sure you do your technique work because you're missing that. And always spoke to me, you know, after training, little things here and there, little tips when you get to the byline, try and pull it all the way back to the edge of the box was a tip he used to give me, because he was like, if not, you'll never get it to the edge of the box, but if you don't quite pull it back, it'll go over the bar and go out for a goal kick. Just little, you know, little gems, really, which, you know, you think about now still. And
do teams reflect the personality of their manager?
Yeah, I'd say a lot of the time, I think, yeah. I think, you know, that's where the philosophy comes from that he's put in it. Also, how the manager is and his personality as well. I think you see different types of managers. You see some who don't really react on the side very calm. You see others who are bouncing around. And, you know, I think Jürgen's different parts at times. You know, early on he was aggressive and bouncing around the touchline, then he calmed down a bit, and now he's a bit of both. And I think, you know, as a manager, that's their job probably to judge when's needed and what. And there's been times where we've had a bad performance and you'd expect him to come in and go mental, and he hasn't. He's been calm, sorted us out, go out and we'd do well, or vice versa. You know, you've played pretty well and he'll come in and have a go because he thinks things can be better and keep you on your toes. So, you know, the best managers know how to judge what how they need to be, not only the messaging, the delivering, but also in what style and how they are on the sideline as well. Do I need to get my team going here?
Mm. We had Emi Martinez on the pod a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about trying to counsel some of the younger players. And he, you know, he said, look, they're more interested in sort of byproducts of it all, you know, the Louis Vuitton wash bags and the personalised Range Rovers and all that sort of stuff. Are you, like him, a believer in old school values?
Yeah, 100%. But I think you have to embrace both, I think, and it's important you find that mix. I don't think fully old school would work now, and vice versa. I think you can still learn a lot from the old school. It was done that way for a long, long time because it was the right thing to do. And, you know, young players we have here are absolutely fantastic. Their attitudes are great. You know, if they're stepping out of line or they're not working hard enough in the gym or they're taking their eye off the ball and they've made it, they'll get told. And I think that doesn't happen too often, to be honest. And I think that's, you've got to give a lot of credit to how the academy's run here, that the players aren't coming up and we're not really having to knock them into shape, and because, you know, they know what's expected of them and they've got a good head on the shoulders. So, to be honest, for the young players who've come through since I've been here over the 8 years, there's none that stand out in that fashion. And I think that's, like you said, the coaching and the how they've been brought and the values been brought up in the academy. And when they come to the first team, they know what level's expected, how hard they have to work and have to keep doing it. And like you said, all the other things, the nice bits and the cars and things, that's always a byproduct of being successful on the pitch. That all comes with playing well and playing good football. So that's always been the most important thing.
Mm. Are you still doing your A-licence?
Yeah, just about. Got a couple left and then I'm done, hopefully.
Right. So what are the factors which will decide any move into coaching for you? Because that's, let's be honest, that's what a lot of people expect you to do.
Yeah, I think you never know what happens in football. I think, obviously, everyone always says you should play as long as you can. So I still feel good at this moment in time. So depends on options and things change very quickly in football. So it's hard to have a definite plan. You never know what opportunities are in front of you. And I think you just got to take them as they arise if you're lucky enough to have certain opportunities. You know, some days it's great. You look at managers and coaches and it's great and things are all rosy and you have a few wins and you see managers getting brand new contracts for doing well, and then 6 weeks later, 8 weeks later, they're under pressure and they get sacked. And it's like, that's the brutal side of football, I suppose. And I think any manager, you know, probably needs a couple of years to get the players in, get the club how they want it and things like that. But nobody seems to get that. And that's the tough part of the business. So you look at other days and think, Do I want to be involved in that? So, you know, I think it would be a shame to move away from football with how lucky I've been with the people I've worked with and the knowledge I've learnt from playing with so many good players and working with managers. It'd be a shame not to help the younger guys, and with me doing my badges and stuff and going and do sessions with the academy now, it's great to be able to speak to them. And it's obviously very different to the first team environment, which is an environment I've been involved in for such a long time. There's little things that you would expect, or not would expect, you take for granted that people know, because I've been in a first team environment for so long. But the academy players, the smallest things can make such a big difference. And, you know, they're obviously like sponges. So it's been great to work with the younger guys as well.
Mm. Is that part of the attraction of coaching, that you're looking for that advancement from someone that you're working with? You know, that little moment where the light comes on.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's probably what makes the badges harder at this moment in time, because I'm going and doing a session with the guys and I might see them again. But if you're a coach and it's your team, you're doing that work in the week, and then you see on the Saturday, it's like, hang on a minute, I can really see that's worked this week, or me and this player discussed this and he's gone and scored a goal because he's made the run we were talking about. And that's obviously fantastic then. And, you know, it's been taken on board. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't think you can ever beat playing, but I suppose when you're helping younger players and you know, you can hopefully go on and see what a good career they'd have, and you've helped that. Mm. You know, sort of giving back for what you've had yourself in terms of the senior players and the coaches who've helped you as well.
Yeah, because both Jurgen and Pep Guardiola insisted when I spoke to them that a love for the game had to underpin any management career. With what's going on in the game today, you know, the criticism's increasing, the strain is almost institutionalised. Is it too easy to lose that love?
I think it could be challenging at times. I mean, you see the amount of media that they have to do now, and like they're doing press conferences before every single game, after every game, they'll do TV, newspapers, radio. And that's, if you're playing three games a week, that's a lot of talking and a lot of people who are trying to get one slip out of you in that time. So, you know, that's the journalist's job. They're trying to get that line that, and you might say something, but when you've been bombarding and you're saying the same thing over and over, and then obviously you have a different story which you want to put out in public compared to the one that you have in amongst the group sometimes, you know, sometimes it has to be, you know, it's us against the world, and you're going to get criticism when things aren't going well at big clubs, and when you're getting praise and things are going well, it's important not to get too up. So it would be very easy to lose that love out, I think, as well. But if you don't have that, I think that's very difficult as well. And the love of the game probably helps you make the decisions you truly believe in terms of, it might not always be a popular decision, but you love the game and you really think it's the right thing. You might see that and eight people disagree with you, but you're the one steering the ship, and you know the best managers 9 times out of 10 are right, and they'll always get questioned for it. But I think that love of the game and that belief in yourself, I think obviously, yeah, that's really important.
Yeah, because managers, you know, are getting less and less time to build a team, aren't they? Mm. And the harshness in the environment, I heard recently of one manager, no names, no pack drill, he was sacked and he took off in a camper van because he just wanted to isolate himself from all the madness that he'd had in the previous few months. Is that sort of environment putting people off from pursuing a career in the EFL or in the Championship? Because I'm hearing a lot of coaches saying, I just don't want to do the aggro. I'll just go and do an under-21 job or under-23 job.
Yeah, I would think so. I think, you know, obviously it's a results business. And like we said, you're not going to get long if results aren't good. And you're always going to have opinion. When things aren't going well, there's always going to be plenty of opinions about. But as the manager, it's always going to be you. It could be a player's going through a hard time off the field nobody knows about, and that's why he's playing poorly, or things out of the manager's control that he can't really control, but it'll always fall on the manager's shoulders. And you know, it's probably like being in a goldfish bowl and everything leads to you when things aren't going well. And like you say, if that's the case and you're not really given the time to turn it round, because football careers, you know, you have peaks and troughs, and football teams can't be on form forever, so you're always going to have tough spells. But if you're not given time to see what you're working on come to fruition, if you like, as the first time of trouble you get sacked, you're sort of fighting a losing battle, really. So I think, you know, if you get the opportunity for a job, I think it's about taking the right one and having someone who understands that. But I can definitely 100% see why people would say, do you know what, I don't need that aggro, like you say, and go down a route with less pressure. But again, with all that difficult side that we've just talked about there, when you do get it right, it must feel all the more special when you're a manager and you've seen what you've created as a, you know, like Pep and Jurgen, the jobs they've done and what they've created and the trophies they've won, that must be all that more special. Mm. And appreciate that much more when you have been through the tough times.
Yeah. There's a final point, and end on a positive point, really. You know, the one thing that I envy as an observer is the emotional charge that must come with playing for a team like Liverpool and a stadium like Anfield, and, you know, one of those sort of mythical nights. Can you put into words the enjoyment factor? Because, you know, when we talk about football, it's all pressure and everything else, which, you know, we've talked about already, but the actual enjoyment factor, the thing that grabs you and maybe reconnects you with a kid that you once were.
It's probably the moments after the final whistle, I think. You know, it's very hard in a game, unless, you know, 7-0 up or something like that, it's very hard in a game to enjoy it. So you have to win. You're expected to win at Liverpool every single game. You know, you take your foot off the gas. you can get found out. And then obviously over recent seasons when we've been going for the title, you know, we've had over 90 points three times, which is an incredible amount of points, and only won the league title once. And you know, even when you've won that game, for that half an hour after the game, everyone's happy and we've done the job. But you know, 3 days later, you have to go again. It's like, right, we go again. So I think that is one of the things that's most difficult, that you probably don't get enough chance to enjoy the successes. Last year, you know, we won two cup competitions, but you're in the middle of the season, so you don't really get a chance to enjoy it. You win a league title or Champions League, amazing, go on a parade, you know, some of the best days of your life. See the city. That's the moment you enjoy it, and you see the fans and how much money they've spent and followed you around Europe and the joy in their faces. And you look around at your teammates and you see, we've achieved this together. You go on holiday for 3 weeks, come back, and the next day it's like, right, that's gone, next one. So that's probably the one thing, when you do achieve something, you don't have long enough to enjoy it. And that's the thing about top level sports, but I suppose, it's something you look back on, you know, hopefully have a reunion in 10, 15 years time, and you know, you think about that. But they're the times, and when you create those special moments, you know, like we go back to the Barcelona ones, because it's probably one of the best nights here. You turn something around and you're all stood together in front of the cop. Yeah, you know, the hairs still go up on the back of your neck now thinking about it, and they're the moments. And there is a lot of, you know, tough times and disappointments and poor results. You know, that's the worst feeling ever, when you lose a game and you go home and you just want to put it right. That is a feeling I definitely will not miss when I've finished playing. But like we've said before, that makes the successes all that much more sweeter.
Well, I'm sure it wasn't a coincidence that you mentioned the 7-0 scoreline, but thanks very much for your time, mate. I really appreciate it.
No worries, thanks.
Thanks.
Well, that was a fascinating insight into a really interesting but low-key character. You know, most players you'd see before they maybe went off to do their latest TikTok video. Well, James was off to his parents' evening at school. So, you know, that conformed to a certain stereotype. Dom, do you share my sense that he's got a long-term future in the game?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact that he's very close to concluding those UEFA coaching badges, and it's clearly somebody that has learned and soaked up knowledge from the various managers he's had at, you know, Leeds, Newcastle, Villa, City, Liverpool over the years, and England. He's made for some role, coaching, management in the game in the future, once he eventually does hang up his boots. He's really level-headed, thoughtful. For somebody that made his debut at, what was it, 16, I mean, he's no reason to be fazed by anything that the game might throw at him. Although I was quite interested that he acknowledges that what can happen when you are a manager will take him out of his comfort zone. It will take him into areas that he hasn't been before, and that will continue in the education and the learning process that he's been on since he made his debut as a fleet-footed winger, really, at Leeds all those years ago.
Yeah, I thought, Migs, there were some really interesting insights into the culture that Jurgen Klopp has nurtured at Anfield.
Yeah, especially, I suppose, in light of what we've been talking about earlier on in the discussion, and how Milner is a totem there. I also, what was really striking, I suppose, was him talking about what he'd tell his younger self. I mean, it was impossible. And also, when he was, what was a real insight, I thought, or just that kind of the kind of universality of it, when he was talking about how when he's overhearing, say, some of his teammates filling in medical forms, and when he hears their the year of their birth. Because actually, just as he was talking about this, I was even thinking myself, I remember, I suppose this is given away my own advancing age to the point as well. I think the day of his first goal, I was listening to Five Live, or maybe it was one of the Irish stations, in my university job in a service station back in Ireland, which is a fair chunk of time ago in itself. But yeah, I suppose we've got someone, Milner, and this very much came across the interview, who's come through this, probably a period in football where there's been more change than any other. And that's from everything from the kind of wider game to how it's played. Milner has absorbed all that, clearly has the kind of mindset to absorb all that. Hence, he's been so valuable to Klopp. and it looks like he's going to be very valuable going forward.
Yeah, true. I suppose the only proviso that I had, Dom, was that he would be going into a disposable profession. I suppose you could understand anyone's caution before committing to something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. But he's bright enough to... Well, he knows that. He recognises that. He's seen enough of it. He's experienced the game, you know, 20-odd years. He's seen the chaos at Leeds and, you know, what had happened at Newcastle Villa. And then he's also worked under, you know, almost more successful at the top of the game and under Klopp and at City. So I think he's seen all facets of that. I think he'll go in with his eyes open to that aspect of the job. I'd have loved it. Weirdly, when he was talking about the advice that Terry Venables gave him as a player, I will be imparting that advice to the under-14s team that I coach on a Monday night now. I mean, it's obvious things like that you just don't think about. And the fact that it's lodged in his brain and it's influenced his playing career. And that's just one snippet. He's got all of this to impart upon players, whether it be under-23s at a Premier League club or even first-team players when he gets his chance in management full-time. And he's got so much knowledge in there. The only thing I'd add on it, we all look at James Milner as this amazing workhorse of a player playing fantastically well at 37 and fulfilling a role for Jurgen Klopp. On the pitch at the Bernabeu, there was a player that was 3 months older than him who absolutely dictated the play. Luka Modric is a phenomenon. And we all know it. I'm not stating the obvious, but it's obvious you watch him and you don't realise he's 37. With the greatest respect to James Milner, but you watch him play and the huff and puff, etc. And you sort of see how he sort of gets up and down. There's always this marvel that he's still able to do it at that age. Well, Modric does it without even breaking into a sweat.
Well, that's a special, special player, isn't he? How much emotion goes into decisions with former players, Migs? You know, I'm thinking here, you know, there's an obvious symmetry with James Milner staying on the staff at Anfield. That similarly, you know, FA Cup weekend, one great storyline will be Vincent Kompany going back to Manchester City. You know, people are already saying, oh, well, he's Pep's successor. You know, does emotion get in the way?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, and you could argue, actually, of course, that's often been too. It's been too easy in football to always think in those terms. That well, oh, here's a former player plays a similar system to what we've got. Let's rush him up to be our manager. Sometimes it works, as in the case of Mikel Arteta, although not without a lot of investment from Arsenal, not least patience, to be fair to them. But a lot of time it doesn't, as you can see, say at Manchester United. And yeah, and again, that was one of the very interesting aspects about the Milner interview and that discussion you had with him about when you get to that level, so many of them want to stay in coaching because they want to stay in the game. Probably takes a specific personality to be willing to put up with all of the noise around management. Many of that noise, of course, the media contributes to. And more specific personality, again, to be able to withstand that noise at the very, very top clubs. But then, of course, that's one of the areas where you're maybe kind of playing experience or being a club legend, these sort of clubs comes into it, because there is that awareness of what it's like being in the cauldron in that sense. But then, as so many of them testify, there's a difference between being one of the players and then being the man on which everything falls on.
So if I'm looking ahead at, you know, potential coaches and managers in the future, you know, I think of Adam Lallana, Dom. You know, he's just signed a new contract to the end of next season at Brighton. Brighton play Grimsby in the FA Cup at the weekend. I'm assuming that they're going to be the neutrals' favourites, aren't they?
Grimsby, yeah, definitely.
Says a Crystal Palace fan.
Look, I think on that day, actually, with all seriousness, the world will be rooting for Grimsby because they are a wonderful story. And you know, after what they did at Southampton in the previous round, you always go with the underdog. But generally speaking, I wouldn't say Brighton have been revelatory this season, because I think we all saw it coming and they were excellent for long periods of last season and finished in the top half. But what is brilliant about Brighton is I'm not saying anything new. It's their ability to react to what most would perceive to be huge setbacks. You lose Graham Potter, you actually appoint an upgrade on him in De Zerbi overnight, which is astounding. It's a brilliant talent to have. It says everything about the way that they are a forward-thinking club. And it's the same with player recruitment, etc. If they'd lost Moises Caicedo in January, they would have had a player lined up to come in. If they lose him in the summer, they will have a player lined up to come in. So they will be stronger with the finances and moving forward. And that is remarkable. And for that reason, yeah, they could be disruptors in the top half of the Premier League and certainly in pursuit of European places. Weirdly, they didn't play particularly well on Wednesday night, but they won against Crystal Palace for the first time in quite a few years, and it just maintains their momentum going into the cup tie and the international break.
That begs the question, doesn't it, Migs? Given the model that Brighton operate, is De Zerbi, rather like his best players, almost treading water and will eventually move on?
Well, I mean, there's already a lot of murmurs that he would, of course, see this. Well, I mean, that's why he's at Brighton. It's a stepping stone, which is it's unfortunate, but it's where Brighton are. And I suppose one of the keys to Brighton's success is they've actually accepted this, and they're almost using the way club managers and players see them like this to propel themselves. It's a really kind of self-sustainable model in that way. But also, there's increasing clubs looking at De Zerbi. I mean, I know for a fact that had things really tailspun with Potter, Chelsea would have considered him. Roma might have, that would have said a lot if they had they gone to Brighton again. but Roma, a lot of people are waiting to see what happens there, especially if Mourinho wins something this year and then potentially leaves, but who knows. But again, a lot of the big Italian clubs looking at De Zerbi. And yeah, it does feel a little bit actually as if we're kind of after a decade when we had a real set of kind of five or six of the really elite managers, Guardiola, Klopp, previously Mourinho, you would have said, Simeone, who's kind of going that way as well, where there is a proper new generation coming through, doing things in a different way, Arteta being the chief of them, who could well win a Premier League this year, and De Zerbi as well, and especially given how tactically different De Zerbi has been as well.
Well, Manchester United have got yet another home draw, this time against Fulham. Dom, I'm particularly looking forward to, well, on the proviso that teams aren't rotated, but I would really love to see Mitrovic against Martinez. That'd be something straight out of WWE, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there's a certain amount of spikiness there with both of those characters. It's quite an important game for Fulham, this, actually. I'm sensing them that they've had a tiny little dip in the league. Obviously, they've been a wonderful success story throughout this season. Marcus Silva's done an incredible job there. But there's another manager that will attract interest come the summer, depending on what happens at bigger clubs. And it's almost like when you've been sort of around, in and around the European places for most of the season, unexpectedly, admittedly, but you've been in there, you've infiltrated it, and then if you have a little dip at the end, it's almost like a hangover that carries you into the summer. I think there's actually almost more onus on Fulham to do. That's probably me being very unfair, because it's a daunting tie to go to Manchester United, and if they click, which they haven't done of late that often, then they'll be difficult for Fulham to get a result there. But I'm very interested. I'm intrigued to see how Fulham recover from these little setbacks that they've had of late, because they were very, very insipid against Arsenal, particularly in the first half at Craven Cottage the other day. And obviously so much of their play actually depends less on Mitrovic and Juan Palhinha in midfield. And without him, they lack the steel. You know, they've been lucky enough to have him for the vast majority of their season. But when he hasn't featured, they've not been the same team.
Similarly with Manchester United and Casemiro, isn't it, Migs? Is he a victim of the disciplinary culture of the English game?
Maybe, but I was thinking about this a lot the last few days, and because it's something that I was talking to colleagues in Spain about, who are pointing to just how it's really striking to them how suddenly Casemiro's being disciplined all the time, because the view in Spain was always we had this kind of invisibility cloak and got away with it so often. But that's, of course, all the more interesting because England is generally perceived as a league that lets it flow more. And we would, I suppose, constantly point to the officiousness of continental referees in that way. So that's something I've been mulling over a lot the last few days. I don't really quite know how to explain. But, I mean, again, some of it's possibly down to kind of this constant evolution in how referees have to officiate matches, not least the kind of the constant back and forth of the rules themselves. But it's remarkable, really. I mean, we're at the point, like Casemiro said, he's going to miss up to what? Just over a fifth of a Premier League season, which is a significant number of games. And of course, all the more influential given how important he's been at Manchester United.
Is it down to the pace, do you think? I mean, I know he's a magnificent player and obviously reads the game fantastically well, but I imagine that the pace of a Premier League game might be slightly higher than La Liga. I don't know. Maybe that's I've just lurched into cliche there again. But I mean, I don't.
Well, that is true. I think yeah.
It's not so much. I don't have a problem with him. I mean, the first sending off that he had was for almost exceptional circumstances, putting his hands around Will Hughes's neck. But actually, if you go back a few days prior to that, the booking that he got that cost him a game suspension for yellow cards against, I think it was Wilfred Zaha he brought down. I mean, Zaha just got away from him late in the game and he just cynically brought him down. And I don't think you could argue that wasn't a booking. Likewise, I don't think you can really argue that wasn't a sending off at the weekend. I mean, they're just, I don't know, maybe he's just physicality of the, and that sort of constant nature that every game is frantic. Maybe just leaving a bit jaded, I don't know.
Well, I mean, yeah, jadedness is actually possibly a big issue there as well. Because we are starting to see that seep in.
Mm. Just on you know, the demands on players and priorities, you know, which are set by those demands. Miggs, the final or the last of those four quarterfinals. This might sound a bit heretical, but would it be better for Sheffield United, who've obviously got promotion on their mind, to go out to Blackburn?
I mean, this is. I mean, even that question is almost a spin on it's a spin on the usual way it is discussed, because usually that's always contextualized by how teams are doing in the Premier League. But then, of course, this is actually a trickle down from that problem, isn't it? Because it's all about the wealth of the Premier League. I suppose, you know, there was a period when I would have said ultimately the reality for clubs has to be that they've got to try and get to that wealth for their own futures. But I think I've done a complete 180 in that these days. And especially given how repetitive football is seen and how even the championship, or at least the top end of the championship, has almost become Premier League B, with the same few clubs going back up in a more rotational way than ever before. What matters in football is actually days you remember. And from that perspective, Sheffield United should be all in on the FA Cup for me, especially given what... The next up is a day at Wembley. You know, again, that's something else that's been discussed as heretical, given the semi-final shouldn't be played at Wembley. But that's the reality now, and that's something people remember.
Yeah, I agree with that. We are entering the first post-World Cup international break, Dom. A lot of managers looking over their shoulders during international breaks, traditionally. Close to home, I know. Patrick Vieira at Palace. He's certainly under pressure, isn't he?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, 11 without a win in the Premier League, no wins this calendar year in any competition. The fallout from losing to Brighton, for all that Palace did quite well in the first 10, 15 minutes and should really have opened the scoring there. The insipid nature of the second half performance in particular was quite damning, and I did look at Vieira on the touchline drenched in the dry and drizzle and just he just looked a bit lost. He had that that sort of haggard look that you get when you know what's coming. He's got an emotional game on Sunday at the moment at Arsenal, if indeed he's still in charge for that game, because I do think that Palace now have to look at it and make a big decision. They're at a crossroads as a club. They've got a decision on the management. They've really got to work out what's going on in terms of the ownership, the ambition, you know, how where they intend to move forward as a club. Because I do think that I feel sorry for Patrick Vieira in many ways. I think he's been sold a bit of a pup in some respects. I don't think his squad is quite as good as maybe the run into last season suggested. They've been so passive all this season. So passive, and they've lacked Conor Gallagher's energy in midfield, and it's really come back to haunt them badly through the quirk of the fixture list as well. I mean, they've had a horrible run of fixtures, a horrible run of games, and they've got what on paper looks like a good run in, but they will be going into that run in with absolutely devoid of belief, devoid of confidence. And at this stage of the season, quite often the only way of reviving that in a playing squad is by getting a fresh voice in the dugout, on the training ground, and seeing if you can coax the quality back out of the players that's really just taken a battering in recent times. I fear for him, I really do.
Decent man. Look, I would want to really just draw everything together now by looking at the bigger picture. There's a sense, I think, Migs, that there's a new era being created in plain sight here. You've got UEFA considering co-owned clubs, or allowing co-owned clubs to compete in the same competition. You've got a challenge from FIFA directly, you know, this new 24-team club competition, which seems a bit of a farce, because if you've won the Champions League, you go straight into the final. The tectonic plates are still shifting, aren't they?
Yeah, I'd be very concerned for football's future in that way. I'm actually, I have to say, that news about Sheffield broke just before we came to record. I was absolutely staggered by his comments in that interview, especially at a point where multi-club projects have been, there's increasing concern about them. They're being pointed out in UEFA's own review. There was a concern expressed about the growth of them. They've been pointed out repeatedly as a real issue for the game, especially for how they handle the identity of clubs. UEFA's rules about them have previously been about sporting integrity. So it's absolutely amazing that Sheffield is thrown back. I mean, really, he should be looking to kind of enforce greater restrictions, not be open to this sort of thing. And to me, I wrote about this on Tuesday, combined with FIFA basically just bloating the calendar even further. A lot of football governance isn't fit for purpose. There's too many vested interests. And this is summed up by the fact that FIFA and UEFA are basically in competition with each other. There is, and it's amazing to say, I mean, one of the Super League's big arguments now, and it's amazing and pointing to something as, you know, as grotesque as the Super League, as a kind of any sort of kind of argument in this. But that was a symptom of a genuine issue which is separate to what the Super League is, which is the kind of almost conflict that bodies like UEFA and FIFA have, where they're both supposed to be regulatory bodies that oversee the game, but are also in competition in the marketplace because they organise competitions. This is why there is, leaving aside the Super League, but this is what's given the Super League motivation. There are big questions to be asked about whether there should be walls put in place there, because we're getting ourselves into an absolute, we're at the point where global football itself needs an independent regulator, and that should be FIFA's role. But then FIFA themselves, they want their own version of the Champions League. They want more wealth. Infantino wants to kind of consolidate his political power, and which is how he's used this growing split between Western Europe, where all of football's money is, lamentably it should be said, because it should be spread out, and the global South that he of course used in that farcical press conference at the start of the World Cup. And yeah, I have to say, I'm at a point, and it's pretty come across in how many times I'm speaking on the podcast, but there are so many fault lines developing in football right now. Right, even if you want to go to the state ownership, and the more recent one, which is private equity looking to capitalize on football, And these are all contributing factors to these problems, especially that of multi-club ownership. And the solution to everything on it just seems to be, well, just throw in a few more games. Nothing else is ever thought about. Who in football is actually, like, is there any sort of team that is looking to try to show some sort of foresight where the game is going, what the game should be for? There's absolutely nothing. It's remarkable.
Mm. And meanwhile, Dom, the World Cup is just morphing into a monster, isn't it? You know, 2026, it's going to be longer, 39 days. There are going to be more matches, 104, and additional teams, 48. are FIFA basically killing the golden goose here?
Well, look, it ties into exactly what Mick said, and I couldn't agree with him more. He was spot on. It's all a competition between UEFA and FIFA to A, be the dominant force in world football, and B, rake in as much money as they possibly can, make the game bigger, the jamborees bigger. That's their big showpiece event, and yeah, more teams are better. Let's get it in. Let's make it truly global by getting every single country on the planet to take part. And it's a madness, but it's, you know, it's not come as a huge surprise. I, on the multi-club model, just to add, I find it remarkable as well. And I think, you know, it would only take somebody from UEFA to go and ask Botafogo fans or Crystal Palace fans what they think of the multi-club model for them to realise that possibly this isn't the way to go.
Well, the domino effect is underway. State-sponsored clubs are a reality. And since money talks, UEFA will probably bend their rules over co-owned clubs. When it comes to FIFA, of course, we know that money screams. It's estimated the next World Cup will generate $11 billion, that's billion dollars. Who cares if the football numbers don't add up? Well, we should. That's why I hope there will always be a place for observers of the quality of Miguel and Dom to hold the authorities to account. It's also why the game needs level-headed characters like James Milner. I wish him all the best for the future.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.